We will hear arguments first this morning in Offshore Logistics Incorporated against Talentine. Mr. Jones, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case arises from the crash of a helicopter on the high seas. The crash occurred in the Gulf of Mexico, approximately 35 miles from land. All persons on board were killed. The operator of the helicopter, Offshore Logistics, conceded in the district court that it is liable for damages under the Federal Death on the High Seas Act, which is known by its acronym DOSA. That statute provides for the recovery of pecuniary damages, but it does not allow the award of non-pecuniary or sentimental damages. The case is here because the plaintiffs contend, and the Court of Appeals held, that Offshore Logistics additionally is liable for sentimental damages under state law. The theory of the plaintiffs and that of the Court of Appeals is that state law may be invoked and applied as a means of supplementing DOSA and enlarging the recoveries for wrongful death on the high seas. We disagree. Our position is that DOSA is exclusive, that the availability of a uniform maritime rule of recovery makes the parallel or supplemental enforcement of state law both unnecessary and inappropriate. The Court of Appeals rejected our position because it held the enforcement of state law is required by what it called the clear mandate of Section 7 of DOSA. That holding defines the core issue in this case, that is, whether Section 7 actually does mandate the enforcement of state law on the high seas. We submit that the plaintiffs cannot prevail in this case unless Section 7 affirmatively directs federal admiralty courts to enforce state wrongful death statutes on the high seas. We further submit that Section 7 issues no such directive. Before I turn to the construction of Section 7, let me begin by assuming that, for purposes of argument, that Section 7 is merely neutral, that it neither prohibits nor requires the enforcement of state law on the high seas. In this event, the proper role of state law will be left for judicial determination in accordance with the governing principles of admiralty. And there can be no serious question about the outcome. Federal courts would not be required to enforce state law on the high seas, and they would not do so. The courts would not be required to enforce state law because admiralty is a federal common law jurisdiction in which state law does not operate of its own force. This court has refused to apply state law even in cases arising on the territorial waters and involving issues on which Congress has not spoken. It follows a fortiori that admiralty courts have no obligation to enforce state law in cases arising not in the territorial waters, but on the high seas, and involving issues on which Congress already has spoken by providing a uniform maritime rule.
Mr. Jones, how far in towards the shore does the DOSA come? Is it a marine league?
One marine league.
How far is that?
I understand that's just a little bit more than 3 geographic miles. I think it's the equivalent of 3 nautical miles. I think the purpose of DOSA was to define the territorial boundary of the United States, or to conform with that boundary. Not only would federal admiralty courts not be required to enforce state law in those circumstances, it's clear that they would not do so. The purpose of the constitutional framers in conferring admiralty jurisdiction on the federal courts was to ensure the preservation and development of a coherent and uniform body of maritime law. Admiralty law historically has been shaped and governed by this constitutional policy of maritime uniformity. From time to time, the courts have borrowed from state law in order to fill a void in the maritime law. But that practice has marked the limit of admiralty's tolerance for non-uniformity. Admiralty courts do not opt for diversity when there is a national admiralty rule already at hand. This is especially true on the high seas, where the essential features of an exclusive federal jurisdiction are at issue. The plaintiffs appear to suggest that this constitutional policy of maritime uniformity covers only duties of care and that there is no federal interest in uniform remedies. It is by no means clear that the decision below contemplates only the enforcement of state remedies and not of state duties of care. But be that as it may, the plaintiff's argument is simply wrong. One of the earliest cases stressing the need for maritime uniformity, Chalentis against Luckenbach, specifically involved the question of remedy. And in that case, this Court held that a state remedy of full indemnification would not and could not be substituted for the more limited general maritime remedy of maintenance and cure. The doctrine of maritime uniformity plainly embraces remedies as well as duties of care.
Well, are you saying that would be true even if Congress intended that state remedies apply?
No, Your Honor. I'm still operating under the initial assumption that Section 7 is neutral. I will get —
Well, certainly it doesn't look very neutral on its face, and I think that's the problem you have, along with the legislative history.
Well, our basic submission here is that Section 7 does not command the enforcement of state law on the high seas. And let us turn to the language of Section 7. It provides, and I quote, "the provisions of any state statute giving or regulating rights of action or remedies for death shall not be affected." Now, I agree that at first blush, this language may appear to be suggestive, but the closer one looks, the less meaningful it appears. To say that the provisions of state law are not affected is not to say that state law can, let alone that it must, be enforced on the high seas. And this is no mere grammatical quibble. In Section 4 of DOSA, Congress expressly directed federal admiralty courts to enforce foreign law on the high seas. If Congress had intended to issue the same kind of directive with respect to state law, it would have used similar language. It would have specified, in the same manner as in Section 4, that rights of action for wrongful death on the high seas based upon state law may be maintained in admiralty. But Congress did not do so. Instead, the language of Section 7 is, as Representative Goodikuntz observed on the floor of the House, and I quote, "not unlike Muhammad's coffin, suspended between heaven and earth, having no application to anything in particular."
Well, why should we take Representative Goodikuntz's word as opposed to Congressman Mann's word, who apparently drafted the thing?
Well, I think that there's a lot to be said about what Representative Mann had in mind. But let me first point out that for 60 years following the enactment of DOSA, this language of Section 7 has been treated by all leading admiralty commentators as nothing more than a saving clause, as providing nothing more than that state law may be used where federal law, where the federal remedy does not apply.
Like the saving to suitors clause?
The saving to suitors clause basically is a provision that permits the use of a state forum. The saving to suitors clause is somewhat different from this provision. But I think what people understood Section 7 is providing is that where the federal remedy does not apply, the state remedies may still be enforced in admiralty. Now, it's true that recently the lower court and a handful of other district courts, out of apparent dissatisfaction with DOSA's limitation of recovery to pecuniary damages, have sought to supplement it with remedies borrowed from state law. But in doing so, they have disregarded this court's instruction in Mobil Oil against Higginbotham that, and I quote, "Congress did not limit DOSA beneficiaries to recovery of their pecuniary losses in order to encourage the creation of non-pecuniary supplements." And the lower court's departure from Higginbotham is not justified by the vague and cryptic language of Section 7. And I don't think it's justified by the legislative history either of DOSA as a whole or of Section 7 in particular. The legislative history of DOSA as a whole, as set forth in the committee reports, reveals that Congress intended to establish a uniform and exclusive remedy for wrongful death on the high seas. The bill's sponsor, Representative Montague, explained during floor debate that Section 7 was merely put in out of abundant caution to calm the minds of those who think that rights within the territorial waters will be usurped by the national law. Now, to be sure, this statement was made before Section 7 was amended on the floor of the House. But that amendment, Representative Mann's amendment, did not have the effect of defeating the original and expressly stated legislative purposes of uniformity and exclusivity.
Would that be true even if he intended to alter the text in the way that his statements indicate?
Well, Justice O'Connor, no, I think no parsing of the floor debate can make crystal clear what either Representative Mann's intention was or the intention of the House as a whole. Representative Mann offered his amendment out of a confusion of motives. He wanted to ensure that state law would continue to apply in all territorial waters, whether or not they were within one marine league of shore. He also wanted to provide for concurrent federal and state court jurisdiction over actions arising under DOSA. Now, those appear to have been his dominant motives, and they do not bear upon this case one way or the other. Now, Representative Mann's third motive, if indeed he had a third motive, was to preserve existing state court jurisdiction over actions predicated upon state law. But what was that existing state court jurisdiction? Representative Mann himself, during the debate on an earlier version of this bill, stated explicitly that state courts have no jurisdiction over accidents on the high seas. Now, the plaintiffs appear to suggest, and a theme that runs through the decision below, is that the purpose of the amendment was to codify the holding of the Hamilton. But Representative Mann himself never said so. And what the court below and the plaintiffs overlook is that the Hamilton did not approve a direct action for wrongful death under state law. The holding of the Hamilton is that a federal admiralty court, in the absence of a national admiralty rule, when Congress has not spoken, will apply state wrongful death law, but only in a special set of circumstances, only when the owner of the vessel has invoked the protection of admiralty by initiating a special federal statutory proceeding to limit liability. The congressional reports, the committee reports on DOSA, noted the narrowness of this holding. They stated, and I quote, "The right to affirmative action in the admiralty against ship or owner has never been sustained by the Supreme Court," unquote. And Representative Igo repeated this point during the floor debate. The general understanding at the time, as this court noted in its decision in Moraine, was that state law did not apply beyond state boundaries. Insofar as deaths on the high seas were concerned, there simply was no existing state court jurisdiction, and there was no direct action for wrongful death under state law to be preserved. Finally, the floor debate on Representative Mann's amendment was repeatedly punctuated by the assertion made by several members of the House that adoption of the amendment would have no effect on the exclusivity of the new federal remedy on the high seas. One may assume, indeed one must assume, that the amendment was adopted at least in part in reliance upon those representations.
Has it been authoritatively decided whether or not a DOSA cause of action can be brought in state courts as well as federal?
If by that you mean whether this court has decided it, I don't think the court has ever had occasion to. But I think it is generally understood that the cause of action can be maintained in state court. We submit that, viewed realistically, the adoption of Representative Mann's amendment did not represent a retreat from the expressly stated legislative purpose of providing a uniform and exclusive remedy for wrongful death on the high seas. Now, the plaintiffs argue that the wording
is — Let me ask about the — what is the support for the statement that the remedy was to be exclusive?
I'm referring to the committee reports on DOSA.
Is that the part you quote at page 22 of your brief? You have a quote, long quote there. Then I thought that was from a letter rather than from the report itself. That's what I
actually
thought.
The committee report consists of nothing but letters.
So it is not really a statement written by the committee itself, and it's something that put in the report that had been written by somebody who submitted information to the committee. Is that right?
The committee reports really are nothing more than three or four letters, as I recall.
And this is a quote from one of those letters.
That's correct.
Is there anything that the committee itself wrote that supports the proposition that the remedy was to be exclusive?
The committee really said nothing other than that these letters were the basis for its action.
That plus whatever the colloquy is on the that's been quoted in some of the papers. And that doesn't really go to the exclusivity point, as I recall.
The floor debate did not go to the act at large. It only was focusing on Section 7. Section 7, I think, was the only provision that was amended on the floor of the House.
Going back to your original argument, if I may, for a moment, were you what you said that if Section 7 were neutral and so forth, is it your position that if DOSA had never been passed at all, well, let me ask it this way. If DOSA had never been passed at all, what is your position as to the result in this case in that event?
If DOSA had never been passed at all, we would be left with the position that we were in 1919, where the Supreme Court could either deny a remedy altogether, as it did in the Harrisburg, or it could recognize a general maritime remedy for wrongful death, as it subsequently did in Moraine, and extend that remedy to the high seas, as it decided it was precluded from doing in Higginbotham. Or it could adjudicate on a case-by-case basis, determining whether in special circumstances it would give effect to state law in the absence of a federal remedy.
But you would not say that there could not have been recognition of a state remedy if there had never been a DOSA?
Oh, no. Our argument is that the existence of a national uniform admiralty rule precludes the parallel enforcement of state law unless Congress, in fact, has required admiralty courts to enforce state law.
And in the absence of DOSA, what would that uniform admiralty rule have been? We don't know.
Well, that would have been up to the Supreme Court to determine.
What about if there weren't if DOSA wasn't on the books now, after Moraine?
I assume this Court would extend Moraine to the high seas.
And preclude state law?
I think that would preclude state law.
Well, does it preclude state law in territorial waters now?
Two courts of appeals have so held. This Court has never ruled on that.
And Moraine apparently would permit the kind of recovery that is being sought here in territorial waters, as I understand it. It would allow non-pecuniary loss recovery.
Under the subsequent decision in Godet, the Moraine remedy would allow recovery of certain non-pecuniary damages.
So whatever result we reach results in some anomalies. I mean, there's just no way to reconcile everything, whichever way we go, is
that there? That is correct. That's what this Court recognized in its decision in Higginbotham, where it pointed out that the result was one national rule for the territorial waters and a slightly narrower national rule for the high seas. The Court explicitly identified that anomaly in Higginbotham. Let me address one more point with respect to the wording of Section 7. The plaintiffs point out that wording before its amendment would have prohibited application of state law in the high seas by what they call negative implication. But if so, the amendment did nothing more than remove a negatively implied prohibition from one provision of the bill without substituting in its place a positive directive to enforce state law. Consequently, even if the amendment could be portrayed as a retreat from an original intention of actually requiring federal exclusivity on the high seas, it was at most only a partial and tactical retreat to a posture of congressional neutrality. If adoption of the amendment means anything at all with respect to the role of state law on the high seas, It means no more than that Congress, having been advised that the courts would hold the federal remedy to be exclusive, whether or not Section 7 was amended, decided simply to leave the matter to the courts, without itself either prohibiting or requiring enforcement of state law. Now, as I said earlier, if the matter is left to the courts, it is clear what the courts would decide. The extension of a hodgepodge of different and conflicting state laws under the high seas would make a mockery of the notion of maritime uniformity. As Judge Jolly said in his somewhat reluctant concurring opinion below, application of state law would make a mess in more than a few cases. It would make a mess. Application of state law in the high seas would meet with no apparent limiting principle to constrain or define its applicability. We would be faced with the prospect, the rather bizarre prospect, of Kansas law applying in the Persian Gulf or Arizona law applying on the North Sea. Such extraterritorial applications of state law is patently anomalous. And even if state law, the adoption of state law, were limited to remedies, that would renew the tensions and discrepancies that result from the necessity to accommodate state remedial statutes to exclusively federal maritime substantive concepts, precisely the tensions and discrepancies that this Court tried to bring to an end in its decision in Moraine. But in fact, the question of engrafting state remedies or engrafting supplemental remedies onto DOSA already has been decided, assuming that state law is not mandated by Congress, because this Court, in its decision in Higginbotham, held that that DOSA will not be supplemented or displaced even by a uniform judge-made remedy. That was the decision in Higginbotham. And the basis for that decision was that the federal common law power of rulemaking that permits federal courts to devise general maritime rules would not be exercised when Congress already has provided a uniform maritime rule. That reasoning applies here with even greater force, because the borrowing of state law not only would displace DOSA, but introduce widespread disuniformity as well. For these reasons, we submit that the governing principles of admiralty, including in particular the constitutional policy of maritime uniformity, preclude the supplemental enforcement of state law. Thank you.
Mr. Hanneman.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I want to launch right into this language of Section 7, which, if you see where the legislators were coming from, is the farthest thing from neutral. When this bill had been introduced before, on numerous occasions, it contained language to the effect that in all cases of death on the high seas, admiralty courts shall have exclusive jurisdiction, and this shall be the exclusive remedy. Those bills never passed. They were up for years. I've cited them in my brief, and they never passed. Those who militated then for exclusive jurisdiction and an exclusive remedy didn't get away with it.
Of DOSA, it says the personal representative of the decedent may maintain a suit for damages in the district courts of the United States and admiralty. And as I glance through the statute here, I would be the first to admit I'm not an admiralty lawyer. I don't see anything that seems to authorize a suit in state courts under DOSA.
Section 1 is permissive, Justice Rehnquist. It says may maintain. Personal representatives may maintain. The Constitution creates this federal system that we have. And the Savings to Suitors Clause preserves the right to go to state courts. And this court recognized in Hamilton that state courts, state-created remedies for wrongful death may be sued upon. And the subsequent cases
reflect — Did the Hamilton involve the DOSA?
Oh, Hamilton was 1907,
before
13 years before DOSA.
So this court has never held that a state court has jurisdiction over a DOSA claim?
No, it has not. But that, to the best of my knowledge and in research, neither has that position ever been advanced to you. But to come back to Section 7 and what happened to it, the unsuccessful bills sought to be exclusive, just like the petitioners would have the court construe DOSA today. Then, in the 1920 bill, this language was offered to the House. The provisions, Section 7, the provisions of any state statute giving or regulating rights of action or remedies for death shall not be affected by this act. Now, the act that's before you, stop right there. The one that was before the House went on to say, as to causes of action accruing within the territorial limits of the state, as to causes of action accruing within the territorial waters of the state. That would have resulted, perhaps, in a result such as the petitioners argue for. Because if DOSA doesn't affect remedies created by state law as to causes of action accruing within the territorial limits of any state, then maybe DOSA does supplant and preempt state-created remedies, which, by reason of the Hamilton, would apply on the high seas. But that's what Mr. Mann's amendment took out. He took out as to causes of action accruing within the territorial limits of any state. So now it just says DOSA won't affect state-created remedies, period. No longer is that savings clause limited to the territorial waters of the state. That savings clause is all-inclusive. Boil down to its simplest terms, the petitioner's position is that state death acts, which this court once held in the Hamilton, do afford a remedy on the high seas, no longer apply there because DOSA has preempted them. But the very statute on which they, on which the petitioner relies, saves whatever force state statutes have. And you have already held in the Hamilton that state death acts do apply on the high seas. Now, we can argue this case for the remainder of the hour, and we've briefed hundreds of pages, but that's what it boils down to. The petitioners say that the statute preempts state death remedies on the high seas, and we say the statute saves them.
Mr. Hanneman, how do you account for the fact that other courts have agreed with the petitioner and that scholarly writers on the subject have generally agreed with the petitioner all these years?
I don't think they ever took a good look at the legislative history or Section 7, Justice O'Connor. In the Nygaard decision out of the Ninth Circuit, which is the case with which the Talentire decision, our case, conflicts, the Ninth Circuit didn't even cite Section 7. There is a line of older cases, most exemplary of which is Wilson versus Transocean Airlines, in which the district court, I think for the Southern District of New York, did address the matter of Section 7 and called it simply an innocuous change in language. I don't think it's an innocuous change in language. I think that's a little shallow to approach this. And the Harrisburg was the law from 1874 till you decided the Moraine case. And everybody thought that the Harrisburg precluded a federal death action in admiralty. And you did not let that erroneous view preclude you from reaching a just decision in the Moraine case. And I would not hold to the view that old error is good error, nor would I hold to the view that error is somehow sanctified by the universality of its acceptance. And I think this is a good opportunity for the court to straighten out the error that has persisted, if such it is. However, the error has not been universal. because we've cited the Safier case and a number of other cases from the lower courts, which hold the opposite view, Rarig versus Earl Beck, et cetera, which hold the opposite view, and that is that Section 7 does indeed save the state-created remedies on the high seas. Mr. Jones's argument proceeds from the assumption, I think, that one federal statute in a field preempts all state action in the field. Alexander Hamilton, writing in the Federalist, certainly would not have shared that view. According to Mr. Hamilton, federal law is exclusive only in three situations. First of all, where the Constitution in express terms grants an exclusive authority to the state. That's not the case — to the federal government, pardon me. That certainly is not the case here. Second case where the federal government — federal legislation, rather, excludes state legislation is where the Constitution expressly grants a power, though perhaps not explicitly exclusive, to the federal government, and also says that the state shall not do it. That's certainly not the case here. The third situation is, according to Mr. Hamilton, where the Constitution granted an authority to the Union to which a similar authority in the states would be absolutely and totally contradictory and repugnant. Let me remind you that Justice Charles Evans Hughes, writing in the case of Just versus Chambers, said, uniformity is required only when the legislation — when the essential features of an exclusive federal jurisdiction are involved. But as Admiralty takes cognizance of maritime torts, there is no repugnancy to its characteristic features, either in permitting recovery for wrongful death or in allowing compensation for a wrong to the living to be obtained from a tortfeasor's estate. Chief Justice Hughes echoed the very word that Mr. Hamilton used in Just versus Chambers with direct reference to a state death action applied on navigable waters. Now, those were navigable waters of a state, I'll grant you. But it's perfectly consistent with what you did in the Hamilton. And if the application of state law on the high seas, rather on the navigable waters of a state, is not repugnant, then I see no conceptual reason why the application of state law on the high seas should be any different.
Well, I suppose that state law applied to accidents on territorial waters has a more local flavor to it than the extension of the application of state law to accidents on the high seas, maybe hundreds or thousands of miles from shore.
Well, Justice O'Connor, that is not our case, and I don't presume to trace the outer limits of the effect of your decision in this case. However, I would point out to you that if ever there was a case that's maritime but local, this is it, because we have people living in Louisiana, working off Louisiana's coast, on the Louisiana offshore platforms, and it's a very highly Louisiana case.
Well, but if the accident with the same parties had occurred in the Gulf of Aqaba, I assume you'd be making the same argument, wouldn't you?
I might be if the Louisiana connections were there, like they are in this case, because you held in the Hamilton that a statute, and this is a quote from Justice Holmes, a statute giving damages, meaning a state statute, giving damages for death caused by a tort might be enforced in a state court even though the tort was committed at sea. Now, at sea has a very broad reach, and I don't have any reservations about the applicability of state law in the waters overlying the shelf and perhaps in waters more distant than that, but I really would not presume to trace just how far, whether it could go to the Gulf of Aqaba or some other place. If the connections were there, though, I see no reason why they should not, nor did Congress, because Congress said that DOSHA will not affect them wherever they have effect. And we know from Hamilton that they go at least as far as our case.
In fact, in the next sentence in Justice Holmes' opinion, he says, insofar as the objection is based on the Admiralty Clause, it would not seem to matter whether the accident happened near the shore or in mid-ocean. So he agrees with Justice O'Connor's proposition that the place isn't all that controlling.
And so do I. It's just that I wouldn't presume to draw the to try to trace the farthest reaches. To me, if you can apply it 4 miles, if you can apply the state law 4 miles off the coast, there seems little conceptual reason why not to apply it 100 or 400 or farther. I don't retreat from that at all. Now, Mr. Jones made reference to the Higginbotham case, and of course we cannot escape reference to the Higginbotham case in this discussion. But let me remind you that no one in the Higginbotham case contended that state law governed. That was a straight conflict between DOSHA and the general maritime death action announced in Moraine. You held in the Higginbotham that DOSHA is the national admiralty rule and supplants Moraine. But you also said in Higginbotham, beg your pardon, in Moraine, quote, the message is that it, DOSHA, does not by its own force abrogate available state remedies. So why the plaintiffs in the Higginbotham case did not militate for the application of state law, I do not know. But the fact is that state law was not advanced by any party in the Higginbotham case, nor was Section 7 of DOSHA relied upon as saving state law by any party in the Higginbotham case. The petitioner further advances the proposition that any state remedy is automatically ousted when there is a federal statute on the point, and relies heavily on Jensen and Knickerbocker, the decisions in both of which were written around 1917, 1920 by Justice McReynolds, and also Chilentis versus Luckenbach, which was written by Justice McReynolds. Well, I don't think I have to remind the Court that, as Justice Frankfurter said in Cossack, certainly no more decision in the Court's history has been progenitor of more lasting dissatisfaction and disharmony with a particular area of law than Southern Pacific Company versus Jensen. Jensen and Knickerbocker are easily two of the most widely criticized decisions that this Court has ever issued.
Those cases were certainly the legal environment in which the DOSA was passed. Were they not?
They were more or less in the same time frame. However, efforts to pass DOSA as an exclusive bill had been going on since about 1900. And every time it came up exclusive, it was voted down.
But when DOSA was finally passed, Southern Pacific versus Jensen was on the books as good law.
It was on the books, but if it was there as good law, it wasn't there for long, because it was —
Well, it doesn't matter whether it was there for long or not, because DOSA was passed at a particular moment in time.
Yes. DOSA was passed in 1920, and Jensen was decided in 1917. But this Court has never applied Jensen or Knickerbocker to preclude the operation of any state statute except a state workman's compensation statute. And even vis-à-vis state workman's compensation statutes, really the very next chance you had to do so, you found a way for state workman's compensation statutes even to apply on navigable waters, and that was Grant Smith Porter versus Rody. So 3, 4, 5 years after Jensen already, you were letting state compensation, workman's compensation statutes apply where Jensen, if you read it strictly, had said they would not. And in many, many instances, you have allowed state laws not dealing with workman's compensation to apply. Wrongful death has been applied. State wrongful death has been applied many times since the Jensen decision, Just versus Chambers, Western Fuel versus Garcia, many other cases. You've let state lien laws apply on navigable waters, state laws for the partitions of ships, state laws on arbitration, state laws on maritime insurance, state unemployment insurance laws, state water pollution laws, just recently here in Askew versus American Waterways Operators.
May I ask this question, please? Were all of the people on this helicopter citizens of Louisiana?
I cannot remember that. The pilot was a citizen of Florida, as I recall. And I know that some of the other people were citizens of Louisiana.
How many people were on it?
As memory serves, it was either 12 or 13, and all were killed.
Suppose each of the 13 had come from a different state, and each state had different laws. Would not the recovery by each person differ, and perhaps widely, and would that be fair?
It would certainly be as fair as denying them recovery. It would certainly be as fair as denying them recovery for what the petitioner, I think, somewhat calls sentimental damages. I don't think it's fair to deny people real damages, even though they may have to do with sentiment. But to come back to your specific question, as Justice Brennan pointed out, writing in the Tungus, as I recall, there was these state wrongful death laws have been applied in navigable waters for many, many years, and there's never been any serious difficulty with that. And if there were any difficulty, I think it would be nothing more than an accustomed exercise in conflicts of laws. Most jurisdictions now favor a weighing of contacts. Most courts are very familiar with that process, and the courts can do that. And the courts can reach substantial justice in all cases, I think, by a balancing of and a weighing of contacts. So, yes, certainly there would be some differences. But in the Hamilton, too, the court pointed out, Justice Holmes pointed out, that there would be no lamentable lack of uniformity in applying state death actions on the high seas. In Just versus Chambers, you said there would be no repugnancy to federal law in allowing state death actions to control. And to me, what's more repugnant to bona fide admiralty concepts is to deny these real damages to people.
Are you suggesting there could be no difference in the damages recovered in the hypothetical I suggested? Assume one state provided treble damages and the other state did not. There would manifestly be a difference if both persons were killed, had the same survivors entitled to sue.
Yes, there certainly could be a different measure of damages. However, you surveyed the law in, as I recall, the Godet case, and you cited Spicer's work on wrongful death. And Spicer's work on wrongful death pointed out that across the country, as a matter of fact, the clear majority of the states allow for this type of loss. And if there's one that's what Spicer said, and that's what you said in the Godet decision.
Yes, but that's far less than all.
Yes, it's less than all. But
and if some of these people came from states that didn't provide for these kinds of damages, they wouldn't get them your rule.
They can fall back on DOSHA, and they might not get them if their states do not accord them. If their states do not accord them those kinds of damages, they do fall back on DOSHA, and I see DOSHA as a guaranteed minimum recovery allowable by federal law, which operates even in the event that the states do not allow some sort of recovery.
In your view, is it a question of the domicile of the individual plaintiff?
I think, no, sir, Justice Rehnquist, I don't think that's the sole determinant. There's a whole body of laws which points out what the relevant contacts are for purposes of balancing contacts in a conflicts of law situation.
And so in a case brought in Louisiana, the federal court sitting in Louisiana would apply Louisiana conflicts laws to decide whether a Florida plaintiff would recover under Florida law or, say, Louisiana law?
I think that's correct. I think that the forum state is likely to apply its own, at least in Louisiana we would do that, the forum state would apply its conflicts laws in order to arrive at the choice of laws. Yes. But I don't, that once again, I don't think that's going to be as great a practical problem as the practical problem that results from the petitioner's position. The petitioner is spouting uniformity, but listen to how his uniformity works. Picture the map of Louisiana, shaped like a boot. The bottom of the boot is the line between the state and the Gulf of Mexico. Houma, Louisiana, where these people were headed, is down at the bottom, about 20 miles inland. And there's an offshore platform way out there. Picture four helicopters at the airport. First helicopter takes off, crashes within minutes after it takes off. Those people get loss of love and affection or loss of society. The next one makes it out past the coast, but not a Marine League, past the coast. It crashes. Those people get loss of society under your Marine decision. The third helicopter gets all the way out to the platform and crashes on the platform. Those people get loss of love and affection.
But under a different statute, isn't it?
Same statute. Louisiana Article 2315. But extended by a different statute. Precisely. It's disuniformity is what I'm pointing out. Whereas the fourth helicopter, if it lands somewhere between the Marine League and the platform in the sea and crashes, by the petitioner's position, those people get nothing for their loss of love and affection or loss of society. Now,
at the platform.
If it blew up at the platform.
No, not the platform, in Houma.
They would get loss of love and affection if it crashed right there.
I thought, why are you going to do it? Why not do it all?
I missed the question.
I see you were covering all the situations. I just thought you would cover that one, too.
I intended to. Thank you.
Yeah.
But in all of the situations except the one, that is between a Marine League offshore and the platform itself, by the petitioner's argument, there would be loss of love and affection or loss of society. And in the middle there, that big gap in the middle, there would be no recovery for that. Whereas by our position, you would get either loss of love and affection or loss of society in every one of those locations, whether it crashed at Houma, whether it crashed in the band, less than one Marine League off the coast, if it crashed on the high seas between that band and the platform, or if it crashed on the platform. Now, that's uniform.
Or 500 miles out.
Pardon me?
Or 500 miles out.
Or 500 miles out. Or 500 miles out, yes. And I'm not ashamed to hold that position because I think it's philosophically consistent with the notions of application of state law that Hamilton espoused in the federal papers, that this court espoused in the case entitled the Hamilton, and with notions of fairness. I don't think, and Justice Marshall pointed this out, I think, very aptly in his dissent in the Higginbotham case. He pointed out, if you will recall, that there is a...
You'll carry now?
Well, we never had Section 7 on our side in the Higginbotham case. So I think maybe with Section 7 on our side, it will. But the notion is correct. The notion is that, and I don't think anybody can argue with this, that there's a certain basic unfairness in allowing recovery to be determined, the measure of recovery to be determined by the mere fortuity of the geographical location, when everything else is the same. Now, I want to close with just a brief parable, which I think portrays the unfairness of the petitioner's position. Let us picture ourselves in a land of plenty. There's a little boy standing on the road, starving. A kind nobleman comes along and gives him a loaf of bread. He's happy. But right behind him comes the king. The king takes half the loaf of bread away from him. The child cries out. But the king says, "Don't cry. You're still better off than you were before." So the king goes on a little farther, and he sees many children with whole loaves of bread. So the king has his soldiers go and take the half a loaf of bread away from each of the children with a whole loaf of bread. And the people ask the king why. And the king says, "Because in my land, I want uniformity." So somebody points out to the king that when all of the children had whole loaves of bread, there was uniformity. And the king answered, "That's right. But the only uniformity that I like in my kingdom is the uniformity that comes from me." And in a word, that is the petitioner's position. And I don't think that history is going to be any kinder with that position than they have been with Southern Pacific Company versus Jensen.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Jones?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. It seems to me that the plaintiffs fail to recognize that admiralty law is different from conventional interstate commerce law. State statutes do not apply of their own force in admiralty, and preemption does not require a federal statute. The decision in Cholentis, for example, illustrates this point. The uniformity in Cholentis was provided by judge-made rules, not by a congressional prohibition, express or implied. Decisions like Cholentis, Cossack, Pope and Talbot all stand for the proposition that the availability of a uniform national maritime rule itself precludes enforcement of state law. There need be no congressional prohibition, express or implied. Let me address a moment the question of the Hamilton again. Mr. Justice Stevens read an extract from that opinion by Justice Holmes. And that opinion is divided into two parts, as I recall. In the first part, Justice Holmes establishes that state law is valid, that the state law in question was valid. But then he went on to consider the question whether that law would be applied in admiralty. And one of the crucial considerations that he discusses in that connection was that this was a case brought in admiralty to limit liability. It was a special federal statutory proceeding to limit liability. And the Hamilton does not stand more generally for the proposition that state wrongful death statutes could be enforced in admiralty in direct actions. And that is what the committee reports pointed out. Moreover, the first part of the Hamilton may well not have survived the decisions in Jensen and Cholentis that followed it by about 10 years. After those decisions, the Supreme Court confronted once again the question of whether a state wrongful death statute would be applied, this time in territorial waters. This is the Garcia case. And in that case, the Court said that because in territorial waters the event was maritime and local in character, state law could apply. If the Hamilton had decided more generally that state wrongful death statutes applied in the high seas, there would have been no need for the maritime but local in character rule of Garcia. Moreover, DOSA was enacted in the context of Jensen and Cholentis. And in that context, the members of the House recognized that the Supreme Court at that time would hold the federal rule to be exclusive no matter how Section 7 was amended. With that in mind, Congress amended Section 7, leaving it to the courts under what it assumed to be the governing doctrine of Jensen and Cholentis of the day. At bottom, it seems to me that the plaintiffs want to do away with admiralty as a special, separate federal jurisdiction. They want to assimilate admiralty to the law of the coastal states and the adjacent platforms. But regardless of the merits of such a suggestion, it just wouldn't work. There are enormous choice of law problems on the high seas. Choice of law problems are obviously far more difficult there than in the territorial waters, where an event actually occurs within the boundaries of an individual state. This Court in Lauritzen against Larson listed seven factors that bear upon the choice of law on the high seas, even when it's only a matter of choosing which nation's law would apply. If we were to extend the separate laws of 50 states onto the high seas as well, the question of choice of law would be enormously complicated. I have nothing further, Your Honor.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in library.